This week's conversation with Beth Seal is sponsored by Sassy Jack Stitchery. In 2022, Sassy Jack Stitchery is celebrating 5 years as your needlework supplies home. Be sure to visit Sassy Jack's website and get your kit for The Sun Always Shines at Sassy Jack's, a special design by Lindy Stitches to celebrate Sassy Jack's 5th anniversary. There are still a couple of openings for the upcoming workshop, Dance of the Wildflowers, with Beth Seal of Summer House Stitchworks, being held August 5 and 6. Contact Kim for details and to sign up. Also, check in at sassyjackstitchery.com regularly, as Kim will be releasing a steady stream of new sassafras samplers between now and the end of the year. Thanks to the folks at Sassy Jack's for sponsoring the show, and now on to our conversation with Beth Seal. Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr, and you are listening to Fiber Talk, the twice-weekly podcast for needlework artists. Our artist this week from Summer House Stitchworks, Beth Seal. Beth, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Oh, yes. Yes. You may have changed me a bit here. Mm-hmm.
Good.
I am not a person who cares much for the small designs. I tend to go with the bigger ones. I don't know what it is. The male thing, I don't know. I don't try to explain it. It's just the way I am. But studying your work to get ready for this, I think I'm going to have to do some small pieces. You really have a sophistication and a color palette that just appeals to me.
Thank you.
Yeah. You have a graphic design degree, but
yes.
there's more to it than that. Is there some other formal art training, or have you just always kind of been artistic?
I've always been artistic, but my graphic design curriculum included all the fine arts. So along with learning page layout and the typography and those kind of things, which you would traditionally think more of graphic design,
right.
It also included painting and drawing and, you know, two-dimensional and three-dimensional design and different photography courses as well. So it really rounds that out so that you've got that art background. They're training you how to see, how to look.
Well, that's powerful. Is that normal for graphic? Because when I think of a graphic designer, yeah, I mean, I'm a magazine editor, so I think of someone who can lay out pages and mess with fonts and make them look good and do all the little goo-gahs that make pages look great. But did you get a curriculum that just is not normal?
I don't know.
Okay.
I guess I never really looked into a lot of other curriculums. I went to Pennsylvania College of Technology, which is in Williamsport, Pennsylvania, and it's part of Penn State. And it was really a hands-on curriculum. But at the same time, we definitely had that fine art background to it and just the philosophy of seeing, of how people see things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that makes a huge difference. And it's, you know, it really taught me to look, really to evaluate what you're seeing. And I do that with everything, you know, from billboards to commercials. and sometimes it's annoying because it's like, oh yeah, they shouldn't have used that font type. All good.
No, I relate to that closely because as a magazine editor, I know the disease. I can't read anything just for pleasure. No, I know what you mean.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. You're always looking, always evaluating. And design is design, whether it's, a store display or cross stitch design or, you know, building a house and landscaping. The way you see is the same for everything. So those design principles just work across all different formats.
Yeah. Does that happen to you, that you see cross-stitch designs in all things?
Oh, yes. Yeah, yeah. Okay. A lot of times I will look at something and go, okay, how can I make that into cross-stitch? You know, that's a really cool idea, you know, finishing-wise or whatever, how can I make that different to relate that into cross-stitch? So, yeah, I definitely look at that a lot.
She can't help it. Yep, okay.
Nope,
okay.
I can't help it.
All right, now I have to tip the cap to you. Getting a bachelor's degree, I mean, your kids are in school, but you're still raising kids. That's a challenge. That's a challenge not only for you, but for the entire family. That's something.
Yeah, it was. It definitely was. I had a lot of late nights because, you know, this is pretty much art school. So
Right. It's,
you know, I'm not sitting there and completely reading. It's doing projects and, you know, painting and photography. And my kids became my models for whatever photography project I was working on. And sometimes they were willing participants and sometimes they were not.
Yeah. Oh, I can imagine. Yep. Oh, Mom, really? Another one? Come on.
Yeah, that was it. My daughter always told me that when she was in college, she was going to take a photography course and, you know, use me so that she could get back at me.
Yep. Yeah, we're getting even here. You bet. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
But that takes a real commitment and effort to do that and run a family. I mean, basically, as a mother, that's what you're doing.
Yeah.
You know, bravo for that. That's tough.
Well, thank you. Thank you. It was worth it because I think it definitely, you know, my kids saw me working that hard at what I was doing and, you know, and it made them appreciate it more. It also gave them a better perspective on how they see things as, you know, because even they will pick up little things whenever they're watching commercials or, you know, see some little quip on Facebook or something and go, oh, what were they thinking? This is really bad design.
She's created miniatures. Okay.
Yes, I have. I have.
That's great. That's great. Are any of them headed down the art path?
My daughter is currently getting a master's in architecture.
That'll do it.
So the answer is yes.
That'll do it. Yep.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And used to edit an architecture magazine, and people don't appreciate how much art. I don't think people appreciate how much art there is in architecture. It's.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It's.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's just when I early on when I first encountered architects and sat down with them, and you really appreciate how they have to work both ends. I mean, the structure has to stand, but it also has to look visually pleasing, and it has to function. And yeah, that's special people do that. That's good stuff.
Right. Yeah. That's exactly right. Yeah. Yes. And I have a son that is a chef, so he definitely uses a lot of his artistic things that possibly he learned from me, especially when he's doing the plating and everything to make things look appealing and, you know, from menus down to the food itself.
Yeah. So you've truly had an impact with your art. That's terrific. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
That has to feel good.
Yep. Oh, it does. It does. Definitely.
Yeah, that's great. All right. Bring this together for me. So you learned embroidery as a child, cross stitch from a cousin. You worked at Woolrich. And then when you're a mother raising kids, you get a graphic design degree. Was there a plan that you would become a cross stitch designer, or did that just evolve out of this collection of events?
I think it just evolved out of the collection of events, really. It was something that kind of in the back of my mind, I always thought, oh, that would be really fun to do that. You know, whenever I'm sitting and working on a project and go, yeah, I'd really like to design something. But, it really wasn't until after I had finished my degree and I was working for a photographer. And at that point, I was starting to think, hey, maybe I could start designing on the side. And so I, you know, got my cross-stitch design program and just started fiddling with it a little bit. And then my husband took a position in upstate New York. And when we moved, I couldn't find a job right away. Mm. And so, you know, I'm sitting there stitching and everything. And I thought, what am I doing? I can create my own designs and stitch my own designs. So that's whenever it was born. And I think I created like six designs. And then after that, I started to market them. I have a friend that was a really good friend of Teresa Wentzler. And it, you know, so she was like, well, you know, Teresa says this and Teresa says that. And she actually arranged for us to meet and for me to meet her whole stitching group, which was a lot of fun because I'm still in contact with several of those people from the stitching group today. And, you know, we still get together to stitch a couple of times a year. Mm-hmm. So, but it was good to have somebody who had been in the business for a while to really listen to her experiences and everything. And it was a good sounding board to get started with.
Yeah, you have to have that somewhere along the way. You can't create in a vacuum, no.
Yes, that was it. So then I just kind of jumped in and started to learn things along the way. So that was, I started in 2006 and it took me to 2011 to get to a wholesale market. So it took me a little while to get there, but I had started at Bella Figura, which is a letterpress company, and was designing for them. And it just kind of, I didn't have as much time to be able to spend on the cross-stitch design whenever I'm working a full-time plus job. So right. I finally just got to the point where I thought, you know, if I'm going to work this hard, I'm going to do it at first with something that I really want to focus on.
Is that a tough leap to make? Because you got a job, a regular paycheck, counting on that income, and then you go, wait, you know, I'd rather do this, but... Yeah, that definitely was.
And I have to say, my husband gave me, you know, 100% support. And that was it. It's like, okay, we're going to go ahead and I'm going to leap off and do this. And yeah, it's definitely a slow process. It's not something that, you know, okay, I've got this idea, I'm going to market my designs, and all of a sudden you've got a lot of income coming in that you can count on to live on. That takes, you know, for some people, maybe it's an overnight thing, but I think for most of us, it takes years to get established.
Yeah, that's not an overnight thing. No.
Yeah.
No.
It's very few.
Yeah. So this, all right, when you make that decision, do you already have a catalog of designs, or are you in the middle of developing and you just have a lot of ideas? That's, to me, you know, what comes first, the designs or the decision to go into business? I don't know.
I'm not sure. I mean, it was kind of, I started to design things, you know, and I would, you know, shoot photos off to my one friend and say, hey, what do you think about this? And so I would, and I knew that she was really on the pulse of what was going on in the industry. I mean, she's one of those people that you just name off a floss number and she knows what it is. And so, you know, I trusted her opinion. And then once I got like six designs, it's like, okay, I think I'm ready to start marketing them. And at first I was just marketing to, you know, making shop visits to Pennsylvania shops and New York shops and, you know, just trying to get a foothold in that way and actually meeting the shop owners and talking with them, asking them, you know, what flosses they like, what linens they like, and really trying to get their input too, as to, you know, what their clientele was buying.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, doing some of that market research.
Yeah.
As I'm trying to market my own designs. And I think that it definitely influenced me as to, okay, you know, trying to appeal to a wider array of people, of stitchers.
Yeah, that's the other part is, you have your own designs, but they're come out of your head and where you live and your life experiences. And, you know, it's always that question. I think, do I do my designs for me and see if people like them, or do I try to find designs that appeal to people, whether I'm a big fan or not?
Right.
How does that work for you?
My philosophy there is, if I don't love the design, it doesn't go out. I mean,
okay.
You know, I have designed some things, and even as, you know, start to stitch them, I think that I really like it. And then once I start to stitch it, it's just not coming together right. And like, yep, you're done. if I don't love you, nobody else is going to love you. So, you know, and I just kind of, you know, keep with that instinct. But at the same time, there's some that I think this I'm doing for myself, and whether anybody buys it or not, I don't care, because I absolutely love it. And it's doing some type of an expression that I need to do.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's kind of a balance.
Right. Yeah. At some point your art has to speak to you and it has to have meaning, or it's just stuff.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So was there a design or a series that you felt really opened the floodgates for you, or is it just a gradual?
I think a lot of it was a gradual, but my Calico Sampler, it was my first real series that I did, and that was in 2012. And it's actually like my first Nashville that I attended that year. And that was whenever I put out the first part of that. So I think, you know, a lot of shops got to know me because it was my first time at Nashville, and it was a series. So it kept it in their minds, and I was able to establish those relationships with the shops. And then starting in 2014, I started my Fragments in Time series, and I've pretty much done one every year since. And they are 8 different small designs, and there's a complimentary border chart that can go with it. So you can tie them all into one. Now, that was a learning process as well, because the first year I put them out over 2 years. So I did 4 in 2014 and 4 in 2015. Well, I learned that stitchers can't wait that long. They really want all of the pieces much faster than that. So it's like, okay. So starting in 2016, I did all 8 of them together. The border chart was something that was also, I came out with one. I think it was actually in 2015 that I came out with the border chart, because I kept having so many stitchers say, well, I'd like to put these all into one piece.
Oh.
Like, oh, okay, well, we can do that. So it was kind of an after the fact. And, but now I design with that in mind so, you know, the first one was all sampler related. So, you know, doing a sampler type border, it all worked out. But now I really try to incorporate the border into all 8 of the pieces. And I design them as what they would look like as a whole piece, instead of, okay, I'm just doing 4 different designs, all right, kind of the same theme.
So with that approach, then you always know that the individuals can be just pulled out and made into little pillows or little stand-ups or something. But for those who want to put them all together, then if you take that approach, then you know you have a cohesive look then. Okay, I see.
Right. Right.
Yeah, the fragments in time, I think that's where you hooked me.
Yeah, yeah. There, I've often seen people's comments on social media where they'll say, I thought that I'd be able to finish this in an evening, and it's a week later, and I'm just now finishing it. And I think I try to pack those as full as I can. They're small design, but I want them filled up.
Yes.
So that, you know, even though it's a small design, you're really getting some pleasure from stitching that piece.
Well, that's, and, yeah, that's where, for me, you know, and I use the word density in my thinking, and that's probably not a good word for it, but there is a density of stitch and color in a very small space, but you do it without it feeling crammed in there, and it's, tricky.
Still trying to get that balance of the, you know, the on and the off. You know, so you can't have it completely filled up, on, you know, unless it's the background. But, you know, just trying to really have that balance of the overall design.
Yeah, well, it works. It works. Now, the other, and now this is the other thing I wanted to explore with you is my reaction to your color palette and your overall designs was kind of that primitive design, more antique look. Is that what you're going for, or is that just my perception?
No, that's pretty much what I go for. A lot of times I'll update an older palette, and, you know, I'll see something and go, okay, well, I just don't want it to look the same as what everybody else's looks like out there. So I try to expand that palette a little bit more. And sometimes it's really researching the colors. Like with the Fragments in Time for 2019, I think it was all based on shaker. Now I'm lost the word, but there were shaker drawings, and they were kind of their dream or drawings where they felt that they were given the drawings by God. And, that they really had, distinctive colors, and their colors meant something to them. And even if you go to visit a Shaker village, the way they arranged their village, you know, there were some things that were always consistent, like the meeting house would be white on the exterior. The interior would have a dark blue trim. And it's because they were, you know, the dark blue meant a certain thing to them. And, you know, if it was one of their workshops, the workshops would be painted a different color than what their dwelling houses would be painted. So they kind of color coded their villages. So, you know, and doing that research and trying to bring that into my color choices. So, yeah, that's something that I think about, too. I probably overthink things.
Yeah, well, I wondered about that, too, because I'm reading a novel right now where the author clearly had to do an extensive amount of research just to write what he wrote. And then as I was going to talk to you, I wondered, you know, how much do you really look into that, or is it all just made up in your head? So you're actually spending some time in some of these to try and get some, at least a little accuracy to them.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. I definitely do that, especially for my Fragments in Time series. I do a lot of research on those. This year's series is based on Susquehanna Valley samplers, which the Susquehanna Valley is here in Pennsylvania, and it's, you know, one of the main rivers in Pennsylvania. And I actually had one of the antiques and didn't realize that it was from that body of work. And my daughter was doing some research one day, and she's like, look at this. And then that got us both doing a lot of research, but just, you know, looking at the colors that they used and how over that, even though it was a bunch of different dame schools, they were all using the same palette.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, just really intriguing as to why was it that palette.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of it was because they were copying the main dame, and you know, because she had success with her school, so there were these other smaller schools that were kind of copying off of what she had done.
Yeah, that's yeah. Because I don't think people really appreciate that that there's more to it than, you know, than putting a you know, charting out a house and a little tree and a yes. You know, a buggy. There's more to it than that. It's
exactly. Exactly. And if you think back to a lot of the old samplers, their motifs, they all had different meanings to them. And so, you know, whether it was, you know, butterflies with resurrection or new life, that kind of thing, and crowns delineated so many different things on samplers. All of those had some kind of meaning that the girls were adding to their samplers.
Mm-hmm.
And it could have just been, hey, I'm a dog lover, so I'm going to have all these different dogs on my sampler. Or, you know, I really like insects, so I'm putting bees and butterflies and all kinds of little bugs.
Right.
So
yeah.
I think it also expresses their personality a little bit as well.
Yeah. Oh, that's reproduction samplers. That's one of the things I enjoy about them is you know, I just like to look at them and imagine the little girl and you know, what was going through her head, and something's a little wonky. She wasn't interested that day. And
yeah. I definitely have one, and it is stitched so poorly, and you just think, oh, this little girl, she did not enjoy this right. process whatsoever. She was made to do this, and she wanted to be out chasing butterflies. She wanted to be outside running around, and you know, but instead, you know, she was being made to sit and stitch her sampler, and she wasn't happy with it. So it was, I'm going to get this done one way or the other. I don't care how these X's are in here. They're done.
Yep. And I think I love looking at the backs of those, because for me, that really tells the tale. When they're a complete mess, threads dragged all over the place. Yeah, just get this over with. Yeah.
Yeah, just get this over with. I've got other things to do.
Yep. Yeah.
Go ride my horse or whatever.
Right. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. I'm out of here. Yep.
Yep.
Are you one of those designers that has so many design ideas in your head you can't get them charted fast enough? Or
that's it's usually not a problem to come up with an idea for me, and you know, I'll have design ideas, and it may take years for me to ever get it out onto a chart, just because, you know, I have something else that comes along, go, oh yeah, I want to do this, you know, because you get inspiration every day.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, whether it's something that I see or hear about or whatever, and it's like, oh yeah, that could, because sometimes it's just a story. Like I've got one design that's been rolling in my head around in my head for a couple of years, and it was all from a story that my niece told, and like, okay. And it was cute. It was funny. And like one of these days that's going to be a cross stitch chart, but just haven't gotten it there yet.
Yeah. Sounds like there's a little bit of shiny object disease there, though.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
Definitely.
Yeah. Do we have an ongoing sketchbook? We have a computer files with half-done stuff?
Oh, definitely. All of that. So yeah, the sketchbook, and sometimes it's just words that I write down, like, okay, you know, something that's just going to jog my memory as to what I was thinking. And whenever, I'm, you know, looking at my release schedule for the year and trying to come up with what I want to see, released in the upcoming year, I'll look over those and say, okay, do I want to give that time? Is it time for this one to come to light? Because, you know, different circumstances, COVID kind of changed some things, because sometimes I have an idea, but I think, oh, I think the shop owners need to see that at market.
Yeah.
And for them to really understand what I'm doing, and so that they're able to relate that to their customers better. And so you just kind of have to, like, okay, well, we're going to put that on hold for a little while until, you know, we're back in person and they can see it.
Yeah. Well, and that's the nice thing about your designs. They're rather timeless, so you can play that game pretty much all you want. Yeah.
Yes. Yep. Yep. And I always think of something else, so there's not a problem there.
Do you have a kind of a loose, I want to get X number of designs released in a year, or do you just let that flow?
It's a little bit of both. I usually have a certain number that I'm, a goal that I'm trying to reach, but then at the same time, it's very fluid because it's like, okay, that one wasn't coming together for, you know, whether I couldn't get the fabric or something, or, you know, whatever the circumstances is, or, oh, you know, some classes got in the way and doing the prep for classes and I wasn't able to, you know, get a design done to get it out to a stitcher. I'm not one of those designers that has, completed designs that are just waiting to go out to model stitchers. I run it pretty close to the wire most of the time.
What did the pandemic do to you? Was it a good thing? Talk about the pandemic as a good thing. Yeah, it's just awful. I mean, it's just awful on all fronts. But it changed lifestyles. And it changed businesses. And did it for you?
Somewhat. And at first it was nobody knew what was going to be going on. So it's just trying to, okay, I don't want to overspend anything. You know, when are these classes going to actually take place that I have scheduled? And it was just kind of, you know, going with the flow and then trying to make use of the time, because it's like, okay, I've got time. Isn't that the one thing that I'm always needing?
Right,
is more
right.
time. And and so, you know, I tried to release a few more things than maybe I would have in 2020, just trying to, you know, keep things out there, you know, from the business standpoint. But also there was more people that started, came back to, you know, whatever, there were more people stitching.
Oh, yeah.
And I think, you know, more people started doing floss tube and really getting into the social aspects. I mean, a lot of Zoom stitch-ins started happening where, you know, a group of stitchers, they couldn't get together in person anymore. So then they're getting together via Zoom. And I've heard of some groups that even though they're now able to get together in person, they're still getting together via Zoom because, hey, I don't have to leave my house.
Right.
And, you know, they, you know, don't have to leave their stitching chair and everything is there. And, but they're still able to interact with each other and just still have an evening of stitching together. So I think it, you know, it did change things, but at the same time, it opened things up a bit. And as far as Zoom classes, it's great to have a Zoom class whenever you've got 10 different states that are represented in the class. And you may not have had that before. If I was, you know, going to one certain place and, you know, it was local area, maybe you get a couple from several surrounding states, but it's not like you would have all of these different places that were represented. And I think it's just such the networking and the connections that stitchers can make is just phenomenal. Yeah. And so that was a good thing. That was a very positive thing.
Yeah, that's that to me, for needlework in general, is, if there's any positive that comes out of it, it's that it has opened the global doors for for designers and for stitchers, because you can, you know, now that everybody's over the technology hump, you can have friends anywhere you want. Yes,
exactly. And it helps with that isolation. And I would joke that, you know, whenever things were shutting down or whatever, and people were working from home and the problems that they had, it's like, yeah, I was doing that before it was in style, you know.
Yeah.
Before it was the thing to do, that's the way I worked. So, you know, it's like, well, that's no big difference for me.
Right, right. Yeah, no, that for me, I work from home. Yeah, it didn't change a thing.
No.
Keep showing up every day. Yeah.
Yep, that's exactly right. Yeah. And it does. It takes a lot of discipline to be able to work from home and get your work done. And I think that was what it took people a little while to make those adjustments. Because, oh, yeah, I'm at home. Oh, I see the dirty dishes, or I see the laundry piled up, and I think I should go do those things, but I'm really supposed to be working.
Right.
So, you know, it takes a little bit to be able to shut out the rest of the world and just really focus on your work.
Yeah, it does. It does, yeah. Were you, as the pandemic hit, were you pretty good shape with materials, threads, ground cloth, or did that become an issue for you?
For the most part, I was pretty good, so it really didn't come as, you know, create a problem for me then. It's just been moving forward and, you know, okay, well, how far back is one company's back orders?
Yeah.
You know, am I going to be using those? Or if I do use them, how many irate shop owners am I going to have to front because they're like, why did you use this?
Yep.
I can't get this, and I need a replacement for it. So I think that it you start to look at things a little bit differently as far as, okay, I'm just going to try to give you a DMC color to match to that particular shade of linen. And you can go from there, because it's not like I have all of the linen sitting here in my drawers to be able to always give a good match.
Yeah. Yeah, that's one of those things that designers do that I'm sure if we got a group of shop owners in a room and let them just crank for a while, sooner or later that would come up, as these designers that come up with these threads and I can't get them, and
yes,
I have to buy a truckload of them at one time, and I don't need that much. I can imagine. Yeah, that would be gotta watch that at some point.
Sometimes you have you know because you're not always working on something exactly when it's going to be coming out. You might start the design process for a certain design 6 months or a year before. And at that time, it was readily available. And then until it's being released, it's a totally different story. And it's like, well, what do you do?
Right.
What do you do with that?
Yeah.
Like, well, I'm not going to have the model restitched. Can't afford to do that. So, I'm going to go with it and make suggestions for your customers.
Yep, exactly. You have a small army of model stitchers, or do you do most of that yourself?
It depends on the time of the year. Getting ready for a market, I can sometimes have five different model stitchers working on things. Is it five, six? Usually at this time of the year, I have a little bit less going out, but that'll start getting ramped up again as I'm, you know, starting to get some designs ready for market.
Yeah.
I have a couple that I use pretty regularly throughout the year and try to keep them employed all the time. it definitely ramps up a bit more getting towards market time. Yeah. So
there's a real collaboration that happens there, isn't there?
There is.
Yeah.
There is. And I think most designers have been through some bad experiences. And then you find some that you really like, and you just kind of try to hang on to them with both hands because you're like, ah, you're great. But yeah, having the communication, saying, hey, is this what you're really thinking? My sister will model stitch for me, and sometimes she's a little bit on the obnoxious side. Really? I don't like this at all. Like, I do. It stays.
Well, she is your sister. She can pull that off. Yeah.
That's right. That's right. And then she'll come back and say, okay, you were right.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So there's some flexibility there. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a little bit of flexibility there. Yes.
But yeah, I can see if you get good model stitchers who can give you constructive feedback, but then also do a good job stitching and do it in a timely manner. That's like gold. Because somebody who's showing up with a finished piece kind of thrown together at the last minute is not much help.
No. But yeah. So I have several that are just super, and so
that's a show I should do. Model stitchers. What's it like to be a model stitcher? Yeah,
there you go.
That'll be fun.
Yep. Well, these designers.
yeah. Exactly. Yeah, they'll have to all be anonymous. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. So Nashville next spring, March. Are you starting to work in earnest to have designs for that? How does that process work for you?
I already have a lot of ideas written down as to what I'm looking at. Usually I do in the fall is when I really do my push for designing. But I have some things that are already a little bit started. So that feels good to feel like I'm a little ahead of the game.
Yeah. Is that, as you go through the year with your designs and with your ideas, do you start to flag designs that, you know, these are the ones I'm going to introduce at Nashville. These are the ones I'm going to introduce for Christmas or any of the other holidays. Do you start to flag those things ahead of time and kind of schedule them in?
Yes. And sometimes, like this past February, March, I had done an exclusive for a Facebook group. And so, you know, it's like, okay, I know I've got that one ready. It will be releasing at Nashville next year. So you can kind of get some things penciled in early. And then, you know, it's like, okay, have some of my little slots that I think about in my designs and like, okay, where am I going to fill that in? What am I going to do with that?
Yeah.
And just see. And then sometimes, you know, if I'm working a collaboration with somebody, it's like, okay, that might change things up a little bit. And, I try to keep things fluid. And sometimes, a lot of times, my plans are more grandiose than what I actually accomplish.
Yeah, well.
So, but those other things, they just kind of go into your back pocket, and when you really need them, you can pull them out.
Yeah, we've seen quite a few designer collaborations, particularly this past year. I thought we saw more than in the past. Is that stimulating to do that kind of work, or is it just an interesting diversion?
I find it very stimulating. I'm trying to think when I did my first collaboration. I think the first one that I did was with Hands on Design, and it was back in maybe 2013, mm-hmm. 2013 or 2014. And it was just such a fun process. Yes, it was 2014, The Ties That Bind. And we both thoroughly enjoyed it. And, you know, you're pushing each other.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes your designs can become better than what they would have if it was just you by yourself.
Right.
And it's important to have somebody that you're collaborating with that you can really depend on to, you know, pull their side of the weight. And I know I find with whenever I'm working with her and with Tracy from Ink Circles that we end up, okay, I'll do that. I'll do that. And we're definitely, you know, picking up our fair share of the load. And sometimes if we don't feel like we're doing that, we'll go, Hey, I'm not doing enough. I need more to do. So, but you know, it's more than just the design is the collaboration, because you've got the printing and then the whole business side of it too. So right. there's really a lot that goes into doing a collaboration.
But doing that raises your design level then. Not just,
I think so.
Not just for that collaboration, but after the fact.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. And I think sometimes it can push you in a design style that you may not have gone towards. Like, because it's like, okay, that's something different than what I've done before, but okay, I really like what I've done. And then that can help your overall designing, because you've got that in the back of your head as well.
Is color when you do those kinds of things where the majority of the back and forth happens?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
And, you know, pull out a bunch of colors and, you know, usually whenever it's a color choosing day, the flosses are everywhere. And that's definitely a lot of back and forth, because one person will have one color in mind and, somebody else will have something else in mind. And it's just like, okay, really need to focus. And sometimes it's like, okay, I'm not quite sure if I like that color, but I'm going to go with it. And it always works out.
Yeah.
So, that kind of expands your palette, because like, okay, that's a color I would not have chosen there, but okay, I did. And look what I've got.
Yep. Yeah. Cause that's what I've always imagined when I saw those, is I'll bet the discussions about colors are most interesting. I mean, you're comfortable in a certain palette, and you might stray from time to time, but the other person's not going to see it the same way. There's just no chance of that. So
yeah. That's right. I mean, you might have a better chance, but whenever I'm working with hands-on design and Ink Circles, we all have a very different style to our final pieces. So they really become a conglomeration.
Yeah.
So it's definitely fun to work with them.
Well, it's fun. Yeah. That's gotta be. Plus it just like you said, just takes you outside your comfort zone and makes you stretch a bit. Yep.
Yes. Yes.
So are live classes starting to come back? I know you're doing one with Sassy Jack Stitchery. Are we starting to see that come back? How is that shifting?
I think I started doing live classes again last July, and then I was trying to play catch up with some that just kept getting moved and moved and moved.
Yeah.
And so this year, I think I've done 1, 2, 3 live classes already this year. And yeah, at least 3. And then one Zoom class. So I think going forward, I think we're going to see that mix.
Yeah. Okay.
I think there's still a place for Zoom classes. You know, especially, you know, I remember we had in one of my Zoom classes, I had a gal who was in Alaska. She was taking care of her grandchildren that lived in Alaska, but, you know, I don't remember where she lived, but she had that flexibility that she did not have to miss the class, and she was able to do it elsewhere. And there's always people that, hey, I want to take that class, but I just can't get away. You know, I can't get to the other side of the country to take it. So I think that Zoom classes definitely have their place. And I don't think that they're going away.
No, I hope not, because I see Zoom classes as a way for the needlework world to bring in and keep young people who have, you know, just can't take a weekend away from raising kids and family things. So to me, it's a chance there. But then it's also at the other end of the spectrum, older people who want to do these things but just can't travel, are uncomfortable traveling, or need someone to go with them to travel. And it's a way for them to enjoy a class without that travel factor involved.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's definitely things that I don't like, but then there's things that I do really like. And, you know, sometimes the conversation and you're talking about something and, hey, I've got it right behind me in one of my drawers and I can show you and explain to you this certain tool or whatever it is that I'm thinking, or go pull one of my antiques off the wall and say, hey, well, you know, look at this and look how this stitcher had done that particular stitch or whatever. And those are things that I wouldn't be able to do in a live class because I'm not taking my whole studio with me to every right. live class.
There is a limit. Yep.
Yes, there is a limit.
Yeah, yeah, so, but the face-to-face, everybody in the same room, there's a real plus there. Yeah.
Yes, there is. And as a teacher, there's definitely a plus there because you can really, you can read the room and you know where everybody is in their steps. And it's harder to see that whenever you're just looking at some heads shaking or whatever. And no, there's some groups that on Zoom that are really chatty. And so, you know, they're typing in, hey, I've got a question here. I've got a question there. And you feel a little bit more connected there. But sometimes whenever you're teaching, you just feel like you're there explaining and talking to yourself. And it's really hard. It's really hard to know, where the stitcher, where the participants are in, and if they're having certain problems.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. The teaching is an interactive thing. Yeah. And it's face to face is always going to be best, but yeah, there's some real pluses. Have you gotten yourself more comfortable doing Zoom classes? Technology now second nature and you can.
Oh, yeah. My husband had to teach his courses online, you know, once things were shut down. So, you know, he had done a lot of research and, you know, we ended up, we got the lights and, you know, so he is very fluent with Zoom. And whenever I do have problems, I can just say, hey, you know, this isn't quite working right. What am I doing wrong? So it's really good to have him as a sounding board and a troubleshooter.
Yeah, that's good to have. But yeah, and yeah, the equipment you need to do those things effectively, it's an interesting process where, you know, okay, I can just do this with my phone. Well, really, I need some good lights and I need this and I need that. Yeah. It starts to stack up. Yeah.
No, I wouldn't want to do it with a phone. So, I had some of the equipment I already had. I have they call it a stage for my iPad. So it kind of makes my iPad into an overhead projector. And so I already had that piece of equipment that I used in teaching classes, live classes. Right. If I'm demonstrating, stitches up on a projection screen or something like that. And so, you know, I was really glad that I had that because it made doing the Zoom classes a whole lot easier.
Yeah. Where would we be without phones, tablets, and laptops and built-in cameras? Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Back in the dark ages. Yeah.
Yes.
So do you get much time for personal stitching?
On and off. A lot of times it's whenever I just say, hey, I haven't stitched something that I want to stitch on for a while. I think it's, you know, and I'll just take an evening, you know, whether it's a Sunday evening. I try to do Sunday evenings is, okay, this is personal stitching time. That doesn't always happen. But, you know, there's there's definitely times whenever I just say, nope, I need to work on something, one of my many, many projects that are started and not finished.
Yeah, yeah. I relate to that, yep.
Yes.
So, but otherwise, is it pretty much a regular work day for you? I mean, get up, have breakfast, and have a day of work ahead of yourself?
Yes, yeah. I try to, definitely 8 to 5. It depends on what's going on. There's a lot of times whenever those days are much longer, and then the weekends are like, okay, well, I can't take the weekend off. I'm working this weekend too.
Yeah.
But I try to, whenever I am working on a weekend, I try not to interact as far as questions on email and those kind of things, and just really focus on whether it's, getting class kits ready or, doing finishing work or whatever it is that I need to have that extra time to get caught up on. But I'll say 8 to 5, but then in the evenings, a lot of times I'll do model stitching, or sometimes I'll get up early in the morning and put in an hour and a half of model stitching before I go and get my breakfast.
Yeah.
So it depends. It depends on what the schedule is, but,
I'm curious how people deal with that, because when my wife and I work on the trade magazine that we do together, and when we first started working at home, we were actually doing 2 magazines and 24 issues a year, which was a monumental effort.
Yes.
But we found ourselves where we finally one day had to say, look, at 5 o'clock, we have to stop. And when it gets to the weekends, we have to stop, because it was becoming this 24-hour thing that just grinds you down. And, so like when you're working for yourself, you have to put some limits on it.
Yeah, you definitely do. And I think COVID really, really sent that message home to me, because I had some time that I could say, hey, I don't have all these deadlines, because, classes were being canceled and everything. It's like, okay, I don't have those deadlines that I'm working on. I can, take some time. And I call those lessons from COVID, because it's like, yes, okay, you just need to slow down a little bit.
Yep.
And spend some of that quality time in your own home.
Yeah, well, yeah, it becomes a sanity thing. If you don't, you just drive yourself nuts. So So what's the next new thing for us?
Oh, the next new thing. I'm trying to think. I mean, we have probably like around the 21st, I have 2 more fragments that will be coming out, number 5 and number 6 for the 2020 series.
Okay.
And then Expo is right around the corner at the end of August, and I'll have the last 2 fragments in time. And then this year, it's one of those things where I put out a design back in 2017. It's called Winter Cometh. And it was based on antique woven coverlets. And it's just always been a good seller. And I always get people saying, so when are you doing the other seasons? I didn't know I was doing the other seasons. So it became a series this year, and it was kind of the unintended series. I never intended to do the rest of the seasons, but spring came out at Nashville, and then summer I released in May, and autumn will be also releasing at Expo. So there's going to be some winter designs come out, and I'm not quite sure exactly when they're going to be released, but the last quarter of the year. And then Nashville will be right around the corner from that. I usually try to get my first 2 fragments for the year out in January. This year that did not happen because I was teaching at the Attic in January. Yeah. And it just, you know, with the Christmas holidays and getting ready for Nashville and teaching at the Attic, it's like, yeah, it's not going to happen this year. So the first two came out in Nashville, and it just kind of pushed everything back a little bit.
Yeah.
But we'll see how things are going, whether I push things back again or whether they come out in January. That's that kind of fluid thing where, you know, I'm not going to beat myself up if they don't come out in January. They'll just come out then at Nashville.
Right, yeah.
So.
Yeah, I've talked to numerous designers, and the minute you hang a season on a design, you know, the demand for the other three is going to happen. You might as well just do them.
And that's right. That's right. I don't know what I was thinking.
Yep. You're locked in. Yep.
I was locked in. Yep. So I am. So the other seasons all come out this year, and they've been pretty popular, which made me happy.
Yeah, and
they're fun. And that's another thing we were talking about doing the research. About an hour and a half away from me in Bedford, Pennsylvania is the, see if I get the name of it correct. It is the National Museum of the American Coverlet. And it's a very small museum. It's in an old schoolhouse. They have a changing exhibition. So every year they have a new exhibition. And it's just coverlets galore. And they're beautiful. They usually have some kind of theme that you know, the exhibition is focusing on, whether it was animals or, you know, a certain style of the weaving or, you know, some other motif that they're focusing on.
Right.
And they're just well worth visiting. So
what happens to you in
inspiration?
Yeah. What happens to you in a situation like that, where you've got all that inspiration in one room or in one building? And you know, I'm sure you want to just lift things left and right, and you can just see designs all over the place. But that's someone else's work. How do you sort that?
Yeah. Well, I use it as inspiration. So it's like, yeah, I can look at that. But then I look at it and I put it away. And then I go with my own designs. And sometimes it's like, yeah, hey, I remember that color combination that they had that I really liked. And that, you know, can incorporate that. But it's, to me, I really use things as a source of inspiration where it's usually not a direct replica. I have done some, reproductions of samplers, but for a lot of times what I like to do is take that antique sampler or in this case, it was the coverlets and, you know, and use them as a jumping off point.
Okay.
For my own design.
Yeah. Because, I mean, it's got to be really tempting to just lift a design and.
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Which is not a good thing to do always.
Not at all. I mean, you know, we get upset about people, you know, abusing our copyright.
Right.
So we certainly can't abuse others.
Yep. Yep. Do unto others, and old thing. Yep.
Yep. That's right. That's right.
Beth, this has been fun. Thank you.
Yes, it has. Well, thank you for inviting me. It certainly has been a good chat.
Yep. I enjoyed it. And now I got to go buy some small designs and start stitching. So you've done it to me.
Oh, that's good. That's right. Good. You'll get hooked.
Yep. All right. Thanks to everybody for listening.